Well, good evening, everyone, and hello to everyone joining us here today in the room. Thank you very much for braving the Brussels weather today. And hello to everybody who is joining us online from all around the world. We are very pleased to see the level of interest on this very important event on the Europe-African migration agenda. My name is Dora Meredith, and I'm the director of ODI Europe, an independent global affairs think tank based here in Brussels, focused on bringing research, ideas, and dialogue from around the world into the European policy debate. We work at the intersection of a wide range of global issues and external policy, including migration, global governance, international partnerships, climate, trade, security, and digitalization. We're absolutely delighted to be hosting this important event today in collaboration with an excellent group of co-conveners from the European Think Tanks Group, the European Centre for Development Policy Management, and the Nordic Africa Institute, with the support of OSF. So thank you very much to them for the excellent collaboration that's gone into this event, and to the team that have worked so hard on pulling this event together. I'd now like to introduce the chair of this event for today, Shada Islam, who I know that you all know from her fantastic, thought-provoking journalism and expertise on European affairs. Shada, thank you very much for chairing, and over to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dora.
Great. So thank you very much, Dora, for that. So talking about migration is not easy anywhere in the world. I think we all realize it's quite a polarizing conversation, can be seen as quite controversial. And here in Brussels, we're no exception as well. Seen as very controversial here as well. So when we talk to European politicians, European policymakers, the focus very much is on a problem, a challenge to be tackled. Now, this comes against the backdrop of a situation which we know we need labor, we need migrants, our economies need migrants, and we've seen during the pandemic, during the COVID-19 pandemic, just how much migrants as essential workers are really essential, critical for our economies and our future. And yet, as I said, in many parts of Europe, we still see migration as a challenge to be managed. In Africa, where the youth population is growing, you have, you're blessed, I have to say, with the youth bulge, migration is seen as an opportunity. So the question for us here today is really, can we merge these two rather divergent points of view into one convergent point of view? Are we aligned, and how can we become aligned? Now, things are changing here in Brussels and in the EU as well. We've just agreed a new pact on migration and asylum. There's a talent pool that we're talking about. We're negotiating talent partnerships as well with our partners, several in African countries. And of course, we have these cooperation agreements with Tunisia, Egypt, and Mauritania. They're also very controversial. And let's not forget the political context of what we're talking about these conversations. So we have the third African Union, European Union ministerial conference coming up soon this year. We'll be electing a new European Parliament on June 6th to 9th. And we'll be seeing a new commission as well. A new European Commission will be appointed. And all of us here in this room know that we're all quite fearful. We're quite, let's say, worried about the ascendance of the far right. So all of these questions to be talked about in within 90 minutes. The rules of engagement are very simple. I'm going to engage the stellar panel in a conversation, three rounds of questions if we have time, and then I'm going to turn to you for your questions, quick questions, short questions, and very short and quick comments as well. Sorry for all of you joining us online. We do not have the technical ability, the capacity to engage with you in the conversation, in the Q&A. So with that, let me introduce, as I said, this really amazing panel. First of all, welcome. Welcome to Ambassador Namira Negm. She is, of course, ambassador and currently director of the African Migration Observatory in Rabat, which is a specialized agency of the African Union. Ambassador Negm has, the G is not silent, has a distinguished career working in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Egypt, including on the Egyptian mission to the United Nations, so, and serving as Egyptian ambassador to Rwanda. So we also have with us from the European Commission, Pavel Bouchiakufs. Say it for me, please, Pavel. There you go. Paul is head of the International Affairs Unit at the Directorate General for Migration and Home Affairs, and he has worked with DG Home for over 10 years. Also, I'd like to welcome Linda Aucho. Linda is an academic researcher. She's currently executive director of the African Migration and Development Policy Center based in Nairobi, also working part-time as professor with the Migration Policy Center in Florence. Last but not least, my old friend and colleague, Catherine Willard, based here in Brussels and director of the European Center on Refugees and Exiles. Thank you very much to all four of you for joining us. For the first round of questions to all four of you, I'd like to take a look at the bigger picture, right? And I've sort of outlined the different aspects of this conversation that we're having. Ambassador Namira, can you give us, and I think you're going to be candid about it, which is what we really want from you, the sentiments in Africa at the moment when it comes to this migration conversation, migration partnership between Africa and Europe? Are there areas of convergence, and where are the areas of tension?
Good evening. I will start with making a distinction between the political dimension and the people's dimension. When it comes to the governmental aspect or the political dimension, we always say there is always convergence, but we still have a path for negotiations, discussions, in order to come up with an agreeable conclusion that we all can live with and organized migration. If I speak about the sentiments of the people, I would say people think we all don't do enough, neither to protect the migrants, neither to protect international law. We are actually negotiating documents that now absolutely against international law. We do not honor the principle of non-refoulement. So if you think about everything in a nutshell between mobility in general, be it migration or refugees, then we are looked at and criticized that we're not doing enough. And personally, I'm afraid that international law is taking a down landslide very quickly. If we're not doing anything to protect civilians in Gaza, and we're not doing anything to protect migrants at sea, then what are we doing? We're not respecting international law, we're twisting it. Then now we've been asked by students of international law, why are we studying international law? This is the world order that we have to protect, and we have to stop eroding it a bit by bit. So in a nutshell, yes, there are elements of convergence. As you said, Europe see it as a problem, we see it as an opportunity. Opportunity doesn't and should not lead to brain drainage in our countries, which is another problem we can discuss later. But at the same time, there is always a path if we agree and there's a political will for agreeing on a proper path for a solution for migration. Thank you very much.
Ambassador, just to ask you a quick follow-up, these areas of convergence that you've said are possible on the political level, what would they be if you have a few ideas to give us? And when you say that people are not very happy with it and international law is being eroded as we speak, I'm just wondering, you've given an example of Gaza, but is there a change in position now compared to before Gaza, if you like?
Well, let me start with your last question. Yeah, the change is a bit political, but it doesn't reflect anything on the ground. And this is the problem. Everybody's warning against bombarding Rafah. Everybody's saying it's the responsibility of the occupying power to provide safe areas for the civilians. This is not happening. So if we're talking about the attempts to expand the war, the attempts to protect the civilians, nothing is working. So yes, there is a change. The point when it is relating to the convergence, the points of convergence, of course, as you mentioned, Europe sees migration as a problem. And the rise of the fear of the demographic changes in the European communities is played on, I would say, properly orchestrated by governments or attempting people to try to get to the high political seats because of the fear of the life as it is in Europe, which is understandable. But at the same time, as also as you mentioned, you need labor, you're an aging community. These are realities. And you will bring people from outside to be able to serve the aging population. This cannot be replaced by machines. So this is something that we have to put the real numbers on the table, and this is moving to the points of agreement that we have to put all the information properly on the table, get the right data, analyze it properly in order to discuss the best path for migration, at the same time for real development.
Thank you. Right. Thank you. Thank you very much indeed for that. So we really need cool heads, is like, and analysis and data to move forward. Powell, there have been changes, of course, in the European Union's attitudes as well. Where would you say the positive changes have taken place? Because we have talked about all the equal partnership that we want to now negotiate with the African Union, with Africa. What are the elements of the positive changes that are being put on the table?
Yes, thank you very much, and good evening, everyone, and thank you for the invitation. I mean, in terms of the evolution of how we approach the relations with third countries, I think that Africa is actually part of the broader picture. That's how the overall external aspects of migration evolved. And actually, by now, we reached the level of, you know, partnership and comprehensiveness, which is the main spirit of our approach to third countries, and especially, of course, to Africa, as opposed to the previous approach, where we were on both sides rather punctual in our requests, whereas we were looking on, you know, from the line of return or admission, the partners were looking more about facilitations in visas. So I mean, this didn't bring us far, and the positive aspects of this evolution, I think, is exactly the fact that on both sides we saw the merit and the necessity to address things really comprehensively. So first, comprehensively within migration. So we started looking at root causes, started looking at development and migration nexus, remittances transfer, overall legal migration, but also borders, smuggling, internal security. Because, I mean, from this perspective, using a little bit what discourse that you have just mentioned, of course, there are groups of people, and rightly so, that they complain that, well, we don't do enough about creating legal pathways, etc. But there are also group of people who are pointing that, well, we don't do enough on the border security, we don't do enough on internal security. So this is exactly as you said, it needs to be properly the balance needs to be properly struck, and also, indeed, on the basis of the of correct data and analysis, because sometimes the public perception is not always the correct one, no? Or not fully reflects what is really, really done. So going further into this spirit of comprehensiveness, I mean, I think that that what we did most recently is we managed also to put migration as an important factor of our overall relations. And this is, we will talk about it probably later on, but this is at the core of our relations and those declarations that were recently developed, be it with Egypt, with Tunisia, and alike. So this I would say the main directions. Maybe the third one is also an important part of the financial support is also now looked at from the migratory perspective, and we even have an objective under NDCI funding, which requires going at least to 10% of migration-related issues to be funded, and we are very much working and to meet that goal and go beyond. And maybe last but not least, we also approached the topics more and more comprehensively from geographical perspective, because our first approach was to look at the immediate neighborhood, And then with time, it grew. We started looking and engaging with the countries of origin, sub-Saharan Africa, also regional aspects of whole of the root approach, which is very well also encapsulated not only in the pacts, but also in the processes of Rabat or Khartoum. And finally, also, we introduced it, and it's very much present in our dialogue with African Union, Europe to Africa continent, continental dialogues, etc. So that those are the main axes to me of developments.
Right, Paul.
I count as positive.
Yes, right. So the core of the relationship is migration, as you've said, right? And 10%, so I'm a bit confused by the 10%. So 10% of your national indicative programs, the amount of money you're giving in cooperation, development cooperation, is destined to deal with the migration challenge or question.
Yeah, that's basically what is in the, even in the regulation, that it's an objective to reach, that we have at least to reach the funding which is related to migration related issues of 10% of the overall spending under the NDCI funding.
Right, and the rest of the money goes to the traditional sectors?
Now, I mean, first of all, this doesn't mean, because let's not, all this is interlinked. So I mean, migration is also supposed to, the correct spending on migration is also supposed to contribute to development.
Right.
So all this normally is should be interplaying with each other. So it's not like migration to be taken out in abstract and then the rest is for totally different things. Actually, what we should aim at is better interlinks from purely migration issues into the development and vice versa to get the best out of the, this investment.
Right. Thank you very much, Paul. So Linda, to come to do you've to you, you've done extensive research with migrants and you've also looked at the decisions and why certain decisions of migrating are taken by people who decide to come to Europe. What have you learned? Can you share some of your lessons that you've learned from these conversations?
Okay, thank you very much for this invitation. Maybe to give people context, my organization does basically research on migration issues to inform governments about who's moving, why they're moving, and what they should do in terms of policies. I've worked in the context of East Africa, so I'll talk from that lens, so I can't say all of Africa. So what we're seeing, the migration patterns are no different from what happens in Europe. People move for economic reasons, but the conditions on the ground are very difficult for those who are moving. Most of them are very educated. So some of them feel that they have to get somewhere to get access to economic opportunities that actually leads to other opportunities in their country of origin. So one thing we're seeing, but migration decisions is not a choice for them. They're being pushed out by conditions in their countries because it's not conducive. And it's important for us to realize that it's different people who are moving, different age groups, different genders that are moving. And some of the things that we're seeing is that a lot of them want to stay home or within the region, but because of the conditions in the region, it's very difficult for them to move. And we are also seeing that there's an important role they play in policy, but it's not exactly very obvious. Policy, I feel, it's still very removed from the people. So I'm feeling what Namira was actually saying about it's supposed to be about the people, but then I feel there's a disconnect. And having talked to them about policy, they explain it in the most simplistic form, but the policy itself is very complex. They don't know how to interpret it. So when you're telling someone about the decision to migrate, how did they decide to come to Europe? How did they decide because they're looking for an opportunity, and the simplest one could be education was the easiest pathway, but there's another reason behind that. There are secondary reasons. So migration decisions vary from people depending on the age group and what they need. And there's a need for us to continuously evaluate and assess that and link it to policy. Because they are the, I want to say, implementers or testers of the policies to see whether they actually work. And when we learn from them, we can improve their policy. So it's also back to that aspect. How do we protect them if we're not already listening to their decisions or their migration experiences? And one thing I've noted in, I'll speak in the context of Kenya, of a recent study that we're doing called Dynamic. And basically we're seeing that a lot of them are choosing to migrate to those destination countries. In this case, we're looking at Middle East and selected countries in Europe, but then they don't understand the process. They are making decisions based on information they get on social media. They're getting information from their friends, their family. So they're making informed decisions based on what? Whose interpretation of the policy? So I think we need to look at it in a wider spectrum that we have these people making decisions based on their own way of navigating the scene. They're not learning from lessons. They are learning. They know that their friends have gone there. They know they've had difficult circumstances, but they still go there because they don't have a choice. So I think those are some aspects that we need to look deeper into. And I feel like policymakers need to actually include them in the process, whether it means showing them the policy, interpreting it in a language that they understand, or actually just having a representative kind of be in the room when there's a negotiation taking place on labor, if it's a labor migration agreement with another country.
So Linda, so even though we all know how difficult and treacherous the crossings are, let's talk about the Mediterranean, people are still ready to take that risk of death and detention. So the situation is so dire. Right. Paul, I was just wondering, Linda has pointed to the fact that policymakers, and this is to you as well, Ambassador, need to be talking to the migrants and informing them perhaps in a more lucid way, more complete way, and being part of these discussions on partnership. Is that something that can be done?
No, obviously, I mean, it has to be done, and it is being done. Now, whether skillfully or not skillfully, we in general in the EU we are accused of not being able to correctly communicate on whatever we are doing in Brussels. So probably migration is not a particular exception. But we do have obviously in whatever area that we are looking in migration, we always have part on communication, part on information campaigns, awareness raising, etc. So this is definitely enshrined in our policy. Having said this, we also need to be aware of the two factors. First, it is, as it was said, I mean, some people, they make up their minds and they are decided no matter what, for various reasons and inter alia for the reason, because sometimes they are in such a desperate situation. I can tell you that you were pretty generous that I was saying when I was spending 10 years in DG Home, that I spent quite a lot of time in also traveling to those countries and seeing migrants. You speak to them, even those who returned. You ask them, okay, so you return, they seem to be happy with the fact that they are now back. Sometimes they have business, etc. Now you ask them, listen, you went through hell. There was risks, etc. Now you speak to your colleagues. You try to maybe dissuade them not to use, for example, irregular paths. Are they listening to you? And they say no. I mean, people who are, they have certain state of mind, they just go ahead. Now, what we need to do beyond the information, because it doesn't, excuse us for not having information campaigns, we need to continue with them. But we also, of course, need to create viable alternatives and opportunities for people in order to direct them into the correct paths. And also, while fighting with the organized crime, to show that this is not the way. The way is using the legal pathways. But we need to be, of course, also kind of trustworthy and then reliable in what we deliver eventually.
Thank you for saying that. Thank you for being honest about that. Ambassador, very quickly on this.
Well, I would say yes, all of us are not doing enough. Raising awareness is very important. And I don't think people see on the screens a lot or even on social media the hell and irregular migrants go through, especially putting their lives at risk. But the point which is crucial here is the ones who return after being captured on a boat in the Mediterranean, for example. Most of these people, if you ask them, they will tell you this, that they would try again. Mm. And trying again here means the level of desperation is so high, and that is linked to development. Without providing these people with a sustainable way to live in their own countries, they will keep trying. That's why one success story is not enough to convince them to stop, because they also know that there are many who were able to find jobs in Europe while they came as irregular migrants, and they stayed, and they have families. So this is the whole thing. They know the success story, and they are after having it.
Thank you. Thank you for that as well, Catherine. Sorry to keep you waiting, but I thought it was worth exploring a bit more on that issue. So the externalization agenda, you've commented on it, of course, ECRE has, and we've read what you've said. But how would you describe the negative and positive impact of this policy agenda on the EU-Africa relationship?
Thank you. I think when we talk about externalization, for us as ECRE, as a network that works on the rights of forcibly displaced people, I think that externalization approach is kind of the epitome of the narrow approach to this issue, and the one based on seeing all migration as a problem that has to be resolved. So we tend to see quite a few negative impacts and not many positive benefits. And by externalization, we're meaning the policies that seek to outsource responsibility for refugees and migrants outside of Europe, and indeed outsource the people themselves. So I would sort of summarise in four main types of negative effect. One is the direct human rights violations that may result. And there I would concur with the ambassador's point that we're seeing breaches of international law, including international human rights law. But that may be something like, for instance, when a country does an agreement with Europe, there tends to be a knock-on effect, and that country may then expel people from within its territory or deny access. There may be attacks or hostility towards people. But another violation resulting is something like the search and rescue case that's been mentioned. This is externalization by omission rather than by action. It's by Europe ceasing its search and rescue efforts. So people would then be picked up by the so-called Libyan Coast Guard, and people are disembarked in unsafe places. So those are those kind of effects. The second effect, I think, is that there can sometimes be a gelling effect of these policies, that countries don't want to build up an international protection system because they don't want Europe outsourcing responsibility to them. And this is something we may see, for instance, in Morocco or Tunisia, that actually it gives a disincentive to have protection systems or respect people's rights. Thirdly, there's quite a counterproductive element to some of these policies. They often reinforce leaders and institutions that are themselves repressive and might be a source of displacement, because those are the partners that go into these kind of agreements with Europe. And that creates a dependency of Europe on those figures and leverage over Europe. It may also be counterproductive in the sense of transferring diverting resources to less effective measures rather than security or development or human rights. And the final point on that, the sort of fourth category of negative effects, we would argue that this undermines Europe's effectiveness and credibility as foreign policy actor. Because it's focusing on a very narrow agenda, which is sometimes seen as imposing Europe's agenda on Africa and African countries. So it's not, I have to say, that's a slightly rude way to put it. I don't think this is really serious foreign policy if it's all about obsession with preventing migration. So these policies are supposed to be about an interest-based policy rather than a value-based policy, but they're not really in Europe's interest either. They don't really counter the far right, because they keep this issue as a conflictual and salient issue, which favours the far right. So I think a return to something broader, more comprehensive, alternatives in this relationship is overdue.
That's a nice segue to Paul, in fact. So this is exactly what you're trying to do, isn't it? To bring new elements into these partnership agreements, to bring new ideas, the talent pool, the migration pact has some questions about legal pathways, there's also the talent partnerships, et cetera. So what are the positive changes that are being made within the policies that you're putting on the table with your Africa, with our African partners?
Thank you. I mean, maybe to start with, I mean, the when we talk about the external aspects of migration, we do not try at least not to see it as a pure externalization. And because, then if we approach the topic as such, indeed, then it looks like we just want to get rid of the problem. And well, the current thinking is not just passing a hot potato to someone else. We are engaging with those countries in the spirit of partnership. And, you know, the fact that we are engaging with them on protection on board of borders is also what they expect from us, because protection of borders, it's not only about you know, controlling people, it's also about controlling overall traffic through those borders. And again, also in terms of foreign policy, the idea is to create a common agenda composed of elements which are in common interest. Now, part of foreign policy is also defending the issues which one believes are at the core of EU interests. But then the issue is also to strike the balance between what are our interests, what are the interests of the partners, and making sure that we are able to agree on a package which is acceptable and profitable to both of the sides. And I think that those, especially those most recent declarations, for example, the one with Egypt, I mean, it's a big package of things which, by the way, it goes way more and beyond migration and should not really be perceived as to be done just, you know, we did this whole thing to stop migration. This is not really, you know, the case. When you look at the at what is really there, I mean, it is there are a lot of potentials in areas which are addressed, in areas which sometimes not even have a lot with migration. Migration is part of that overall deal, and it is important for us indeed that we reach that stage in the migration policy making, that it is indeed among those very important topics. Now, talking about Egypt, I mean, when you talk to Egypt to our Egyptian counterparts, they said that actually this linkage between that declaration and migration purely was made much more in Europe than in Egypt, because in Egypt, actually, funny enough, people were looking at opportunities. I mean, there's serious amount of investment possibilities and financial support which can boost the relations and the economy. Then eventually it should trickle down also to a better better management of migration. But again, it's not only about migration and not only about you know, just kind of exchanging money for less irregular migration. It's way more complex than this. And we, again, we believe that it is in the spirit of partnership and common interests.
Thank you, Paul. So Linda, just to come to you, one part of the Migration and Asylum Pact is also about legal pathways and, of course, migration partnerships. And I just wanted to know your point of view about this. What are the positive elements? What works? What will not work?
I think this is an important question, because many African countries are looking at legal pathways for, you know, opportunities and expanding the focus beyond certain skill sets. And that's one aspect that at least I'm glad there's an openness to it, that conversation. But it's about wondering what will be negotiated on the table and who will be in the room negotiating those discussions. Because we can have policymakers talking about legal pathways, but then it's very disconnected from the migration experiences, what we're talking about, migration decisions. And on the flip side, I'm looking at the countries that I've worked in, and I'm just seeing that some of the countries or the governments are looking at outward migration, but not the full migration cycle. So someone going somewhere and then coming back with the skills, facilitated return, kind of, that will actually link to development. So I would want to see more of legal pathways that is comprehensive, in the sense when someone goes out there and there's a skill that they acquire, it can come back and actually contribute to development. And whether that's clear in some selected countries, I've not seen it in mine, but it's somewhere where you can actually create an opportunity there. But then there's that aspect of equality as well. When you're negotiating it, what is being negotiated on the table that is of benefit to both? And I think that's where, as a researcher, I look at what do we know about the migrants, what they're going to do, what kind of job, are they decent jobs? Human rights issues, protection issues factored into that? Are they? Is it something that a migrant would say, I agree with this approach? So I feel like that is where I'm coming from. I have more questions, and I hope that some of these answers will be answered, but I'm at least glad that conversation is being had. It wasn't there before. And there's a need to actually expand the focus to include other skills. We always assume low skills. This is a debate I think we have in Africa. I don't think any skill is low, because I feel like sometimes you can't do a job of a cleaner or of someone who's doing something that is very technical or hands-on, or a mechanic or a plumber. Those are skills that actually people look down upon, or they actually see them as low, but they're not low skilled. So will there be pathways to include those skill sets? Will there be pathways that include the skill sets of refugees and asylum seekers? Because the idea is to create legal pathways for all migrants. So I think you need to expand that focus, and I think we need to have a wider discussion and have all the players in the room.
You're focusing a lot on inclusive discussions, and I think that's a very important point. Ambassador Namira, so returns and reintegration, Linda's spoken about it, Paul has spoken about it. From your point of view, are African governments really focusing on that aspect of the relationship with the European Union?
Well, I think it is looked at from the overall perspective that Paul spoke about, because the partnerships that I was lucky enough to be, I don't want to look so old, but I was there when the first partnership agreement was actually worked out with the European Union, between Egypt and the European Union. And I was a negotiator for the neighborhood policy for Egypt. I was still there. So I know what's there. And I know it's an overall document that tackles every aspect of development. And that's why I agree that it's not seen, whatever is happening now, is not only seen per se for migration. But of course, internationally, it's connected to migration because of the world like around that migration is the issue. If we're thinking about the returnees, if they are returning to their own countries, and they will be able to sustain their life there, no one will say no to that. But the whole problem is, which is the main issue when we speak about, maybe I'll move to reintegration, if we speak about reintegration, is a bit hurdled, because some of those who come in irregular pathways, in order to pay the fees for going into a boat, they take money from the entire neighborhood. They cannot afford it. So in order to pay the smugglers to come on a boat, and they pay this money, and they come back with no money to pay them back. So it's a shameful exercise if they go back to their area with no work, with no success, and also no money even to pay back their debts. So this is not a sustainable way, and that's why these people want to return all again. The problem will be the returnees if we speak about third states, and this is a real issue, because then here you are asking people to integrate in a country and a culture that's not theirs, and you're telling them that's the best you can have. They have already left because they are desperate in a certain area or whatever their conditions were. And you're taking them to almost close living conditions and you give them some money. That is not even sustainable in my point of view. We have to find a more sustainable approach to make sure that the ones who return will return and have a positive impact on their community, then that as such would be a deterrent for others. They would know that this will make a difference. They don't need to go and risk their lives in order to do this. It depends, again, what we are funding and what we're calling for. Definitely the programs for reintegration and having the returns, everybody is engaged in the discussion. The governments are serious about it. But the whole thing is how it is done is the clue. Thank you.
Right. And yet I have to say there is experience in this because I mean, also my experience shows I've been following this in Afghanistan, for instance, and that was a big issue. Also, refugees going back, say, from Iran or Pakistan and having jobs and employment when they went back, a lot of money was spent on that. So I'm sure there are lessons out there, experience out there that we can learn from other parts of the global south. Absolutely. Thank you for that, Ambassador. So, Catherine, you've and ECRE and you have focused quite a lot on border, the situation at borders, border controls. And so I was just wondering, do you see any changes, any constructive, positive changes that the Migration Pact and other initiatives will bring to the table?
Well, the pact, by which we mean the package of EU asylum reforms that have just been adopted with much fanfare on some sides, not on our side, but from some, is something that we consider to be a quite negative development. And the idea behind it is really the policies of deterrence to discourage people from seeking protection in Europe. But we're working in a context where, as Linda so rightly said, many people don't have a choice. Levels of forcible displacement are very high. And in fact, a majority of those seeking protection in Europe are found to be in need of international protection. So some of the changes that will be brought in by these reforms include more people being kept in detention at the borders. They include more people having asylum applications examined in what we would consider substandard procedures, border procedures, accelerated procedures, or being sort of filtered out by inadmissibility procedures. And that meaning that people may be less likely to have a status. And then there's also elements such as punishment of people who move on within Europe, the so-called secondary movement, which is better described, I think, as onward movement, because people have moved before they get to Europe, where, for instance, reception conditions may be withdrawn. And that may lead to more people in situations of destitution or a precarious, irregular situation. There's also the risk that there is actually an increased responsibility of countries at the borders, and our fear is that that may result in denials of entry or further cutting of search and rescue. So it's quite a negative picture. On the other hand, there are positive developments. I mean, there are in parallel initiatives to try to expand legal pathways, safe routes for people who need protection, but also people who don't, who are moving for economic reasons, has to be an alternative. And I think the economic pressure in Europe, on some level, it does work in that direction, despite the restrictive policies that we see. There's also increased monitoring at the borders. Part of the reforms put in place monitoring mechanisms. There is also active resistance from NGOs, refugee communities in Europe, analysts, lawyers. And I think we also have, there's a positive sense in which these reforms are over and we can now return to the question of compliance and trying to ensure that European states respect their obligations for people seeking protection and other migrants. And then, finally, on the positive alternative side, we have had this experience of the response to displacement from Ukraine. And that shows that when Europe decides to manage a major, historically significant displacement crisis, it can manage. Mm-hmm. Different tools can be used. So we would like to see that applying to people from all regions who may feel have no choice but to flee towards Europe.
There was a moment, wasn't there, after the Russian aggression and the Ukrainian influx of refugees, where we thought, aha, we found a way forward and this will be replicated. And there were even parliamentarians saying that. I remember very well writing about it. But of course, it didn't happen, which I agree with you is a problem. So let's move on to the third round. And while I do so, please start thinking about the questions that you will put to our panelists, because this will be the last time you hear me asking questions. And Ambassador Namira, looking forward, looking ahead, narratives are of course very important. And I think perhaps you could give us an idea of how you think new narratives are needed to take this relationship forward, this EU-Africa partnership.
I do believe that new narratives should start with having enough reaching campaigns to the media. Reaching the people is so important to change the narrative. There is difference between the narratives in the meeting rooms between officials, because officials negotiate based on political aspects more than anything. But for changing really the narratives, in relation to either the stories that should be shown of success of returnees or the hurdles people go through if they go irregular paths, or even telling the people what are the regular paths. This is the whole thing. People don't know that there is a regular path for migration. This is the whole thing. We need to do more. All of us, we need to do more in order to do this reach out. The other thing to change the narrative is to rethink somehow our political hypocrisy. And I have to say that, maybe it will put me in trouble, but this is what I believe in. Why? Because sometimes we say we want to change the narratives, but we don't change it in reality. We change titles, but we follow the same policies. We only come, say, okay, here's the deal. We need to rethink through something, but we come up with the same conclusion. So this is not changing the narrative. We have to be serious about changing the narrative. And in reality, when it comes to migration, changing the narrative has to do with how we run development programs, how we think of development, how we are really thinking of sustainable way of development in order to limit migration, limit mobility. It will not happen as long as people are not living at least at a minimum inhumane level. And this will not happen unless we are serious about development and the development to be done in Africa and to reach people in Africa on the grassroots level, not the elite. The other thing is, which is so important, and I have to say that because I don't think anybody's saying it, changing the narrative when it comes to this called talent or skilled labor, because this will lead to brain drainage. At the same time, when we speak about the cost, because here I'm coming from the other side of, like, the other face of the coin, when we speak about how much does it cost our governments to get a child up to be a doctor or an engineer, and you take them for free, and you come and say you pay for migration. This is something also we have to think about and take it into consideration in changing the narrative when we speak about the talent pooling, and to make sure it does not lead to brain drainage in our countries, because that will affect development negatively. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ambassador, for that. So I'll go to Paul. Maybe you have a quick response to this, but also to the question of the brain drain that the ambassador has raised, but also just looking ahead, again, the greatest opportunity you see in this new, let's say, new era that we're hopefully starting with EU-Africa relationship.
Yes, thank you. The opportunity is a pretty obvious thing when we look at the demography and when we look at the economic needs. Of course, we need to invest in the legal pathways, but this is an opportunity which needs to be managed, because for all sorts of reasons. I mean, starting exactly from the brain drain. When we were engaging in some of our talent partnership talks with our partners, well, we were thinking that they would be unanimously very offensive in terms of big numbers to be, you know, to be able to go to Europe and to work. It is not the case. Some, yes, but some others, they are rather very cautious, exactly for the reasons of brain drain, and we need to bear that in mind. Another thing is obviously we need to create sufficiently reliable and good channels which will be appealing to people, and here we still, you know, we are working on it, and at the EU level it's well, you all know the complexity of the EU legal order. Some things can be done at EU level, some things we need to work with member states competences, etc. So here we need to invest. And finally, also it requires definitely trust building, and this trust will have to be built also through the measures on borders, on addressing smuggling, on addressing internal security, because those are also worries of people here. And you know, if something goes wrong or under one of those schemes, it will be exactly people under this scheme who will pay, just because there was one case which was mismanaged. So this is also something that we need to address, and we need to properly communicate to our population that it's not that we don't want to migration, we want to properly manage migration, because migration is now an interest. It's just we need to, you know, make sure that we properly manage it. And then maybe just few words on the pact, because that's the basically the spirit of the pact, and we were the external part of the pact. We were already implementing even before the adoption of the legislative package, because simply due to the nature of that. But certain things, there, I would not determine only as, you know, deterring policy. First of all, I mean, even leaving aside Ukraine case, let's not forget that EU is one of the major, or if not the major, receiving area of asylum applications. Only last year we had 1.1 million. It's not nothing, and it is not just one exceptional year. And I'm not talking about Ukrainians here, because the Ukrainians are totally yet different numbers. We are receiving area. It's just that we need to also address the situations in which we receive big numbers of nationalities which come here for economic reasons. And that's where we need to do the work in order to offer those people the legal pathways and not leave them with organized crime phenomena.
Thank you very much. Linda, to come to you, you're looking forward to some recommendations you may have, the opportunities coming up in this new, let's say, partnership that we're trying to forge with African countries. The reset that we're trying to achieve.
I think that reset needs to look at what has been learned over the past couple of years, and being honest about what you did not anticipate. Because some of these agreements, we always plan it in such a way, but then something comes up and interrupts the process or is a result of that. So what can we learn from that? And then learning from what value it has been having migrants and asylum seekers. Because I feel sometimes when I read research, I don't know whether it's the sources that I'm getting or what, but then I just feel sometimes it's very negative, especially when it comes from Africa. So that aspect of changing the narrative has to start at some point. And there's a lot of narrative on the continent. And right now, Africa is taking charge of trying to learn more about migration. Well, who's moving, why they're moving, what pathways do they take, and how they can actually support or create protective measures where they go or during their pathway and address that aspect. But I think the greatest opportunity that we're missing is that aspect of the migrant voices. Right now, they are verbalizing what your policy or program looks like to them. As I mentioned, they are testing this agreement. They are telling us where the gaps are. So how are we learning from that? And the reason I'm bringing that is because we have this issue where, as a researcher, I go to the field almost to the same population, different groups. And they're frustrated that we are 10 people asking the same question. We've not seen results. So how do we show them that something is working and we're including their voices? I think that's where the trust element comes out. And I'm talking from the African continent. I don't know how that conversation is in Europe, but there's that aspect of, we've told you this, we've told this other organization this. I'm really tired of talking about it. Show us something that actually says we're being protected. So I think that's an opportunity you need to harness. Otherwise, at some point, you'll get no communication, no feedback, no information from the migrants, and that they'll start policing and gatekeeping their information. So I think taking advantage of that and seeing how you can utilize that information for the benefit to develop pathways will be very useful going forward.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Linda. So Catherine, final question to you from me, and then I'll turn to the participants here. You know, Paul has made a very good point about the fact that the European Union has taken large numbers of migrants, racialized migrants from the global south, in addition to Ukraine. But yet, the border control and the detention centers and the wreckages and the deaths are also taking place. So how do we actually reconcile these two realities?
Well, Europe is hosting refugees. 1.1 million people arrived to seek protection, but there are 100 million, over 100 million people who are forcibly displaced globally, and only two European countries are in the top 10 of major refugee hosting countries. One is Turkey and one is Germany. So it is important that Europe has a functioning asylum system, but I don't think we can argue that Europe is doing more than other regions.
Right.
There are major refugee hosting countries, which are often the countries
neighbors.
Close to, exactly, neighbouring yeah. Yeah. countries.
Yeah.
I mean, I think if we look at this in the context of EU-Africa relations, and to me, it's something is about having just a better balance in this debate, and then having in the policy and the practice a better balance. So migration to be part of that relationship, but perhaps lower priority. It doesn't need to be dominating EU-Africa relations. So that would be one element. All the other objectives of foreign policy are also related and just as relevant, be that trade, security, human rights, development, livelihoods, and so on. So migration to have its proper place. And I find that when I visit African countries, people think we've gone mad in Europe, that we're so focused on this and from a narrow perspective. And I think that is partly to do with the intrusion of internal policy objectives and internal policymakers into foreign policy. So we also have to respect the expertise and the knowledge of diplomats, development specialists, others working in the international sphere. The other part of balance, I think, is within migration itself. It is part of foreign policy. It's there. It's part of EU-Africa relations. But to have more, a better balance in terms of the different elements of that, so that it's not, as it's sometimes right. perceived to be, Europe's anti-migration agenda. It's also about tackling the reasons for displacement, Europe's role in generating displacement in the first place, mobility, questions, circular migration, all kinds of other elements. And then right. finally, I would say there's also the balance of interest between Europe and Africa, but a different interpretation of what Europe's interests are, perhaps a somewhat more enlightened approach to Europe's interests if we're going to move away from a normative and value-based foreign policy. And within that, I think perhaps a better balance between the EU and the EU member states, mm-hmm. because one of the reasons for this situation, I would argue, is that we're seeing the EU trying to do what the states want rather than forging its own path. And when it comes to Africa, European EU member states don't have many common interests. And one interest that they see in common is this anti-migration agenda. So I think the EU forging its own path rather than being in this current phase of being rather more subservient to member states, I think would also be allow for a better balance in the relationship with Africa, also there with the African right. Union as well as African states.
Mm. Thank you very much for that, Catherine, as well. And of course, migration has shot up the agenda as of 2015. I mean, I followed EU foreign policy for years and years, and you know, it was part of the discussion sometimes, but not always. So you're absolutely right. So I turn to you for questions and comments. Please keep them short and snappy. Let's take Asad Beg from External Action Service. Here first. Thank you, Maggie.
Migration is part of it, but not completely. I'd say our relations are under four themes. The first is prosperity, second is peace, the third is people, which is migration policy, and third is the fourth is the planet. But a question for the ambassador neighboring is, we're also talking about this is prosperity. We didn't hear about the global gateway. I'd like to hear what you have said about this and investing in people, which question for a little bit would be how do you change the brain drains into brain gain and what is the role of the African European diaspora? And question for Carlo would be building trust, how do you address the challenges of double standards and human rights? Where do we find the balance between interests and boundaries and the allegations that international law are racialized international law? You mentioned the answer. The question for Catherine would be, I understand 70 or 80% of migration is within Africa.
Yeah.
What about climate change or climate refugees? If you look in the crystal ball, what do you see for the good, bad, and non-good and how is migration?
Thank you, Asad. The other gentleman here, Maggie. Yes, please. I'm going to take three or four questions and then yes, I see you. Yeah, I do. And I do.
But seven Belgian companies, private companies. Hello.
Yes, we can
I'm
hear you.
I'm talking about a program from seven Belgian private companies. It's called Circle Migration for Young African Professionals. So the idea is to live to Belgium for 1 year and pay them, to work here and then after 1 year they go back. In the context of that program, I have been able to interview 900 young engineers, economists, ICT specialists in Africa, from seven different sub-Saharan countries. Their solution for all this is, why does Europe not invest in manufacturing industrialization in Africa? If we do that, that's all problems, that's all problems that come.
Thank you for that. There's a lady over there, right? Could you keep your hand up, please? Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
I think turn your microphone on, please.
Sorry.
Yeah.
All right. So if you go, there's this multi-annual indicative program, MIPs, that the EU has with about 49 African countries. And one of the core aspects of it is on migration. So I'm going to be speaking particularly for my home country, Nigeria, and because I did a study of that document. So you see that... I think I'm talking to my Linda. So I'm going to be asking if you have had the opportunity to go through that document, you would see a lot that it is the EU that is funding it. And so a whole lot of the narrative or the decision is from the EU said, this is their focal interest or their core areas. So it keeps making me ask the question, where, for example, there's a team Europe that is supposed to be like the team handling the, being in charge of the whole MIP program. And so I kept asking myself, where is the team Africa? You see, it was a question that kept coming. Where is the team Africa? Now on the question on return and reintegration, can it work? Yes. But the thing is that like she rightly said, there is so much gap. I had the privilege of working with returnees in my country for 5 years in the development sector. There is so much gap. For example, again, I ask, why do we focus a lot on entrepreneurship? We forget that when most of these returnees, most of these migrants, they leave when they are like maybe 18. A lot of them leave because they cannot afford academics. They cannot afford education. And then someone tells them, I'm going to sponsor you to school. And then when they return with all of the trauma, someone then says, oh, go and become an entrepreneur. With what?
Right.
You see, so in as much as the conversation is enriching, I think we really need to like narrow it down to the nitty gritty to be able to understand why some of these things that are in place, which are ideally supposed to work, are not working.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Very, very good points. Yeah. Anna Noel here, please. Anna, keep your hand up, please.
Thank you, Shada, and thanks for the good discussion. I'm Anna from ECDPM. I wanted to follow up on what has been raised by the EAS colleague and whether different policy agendas are sufficiently connected when it comes to investment. And Global Gateway has been mentioned. I mean, the EU is supporting in African countries several transitions, green transition, digital transition with Global Gateway. And at the same time, we have the talent partnerships, and we know that in precisely these sectors, we need a lot of skills and talent ourselves to drive these. Employers in European countries are specifically for the IT sector and jobs related to green transition, engineers looking for skills outside Europe. So my question maybe to Pavel or the EU Commission is, are these sufficiently connected? When we bring in the question of brain drain, are we not precisely sort of trying to get talents in these sectors that we're also supporting? And from research and sort of knowledge community, we discussed the skills partnership, the talent partnerships are somehow built on that, but is it sufficiently connected in your opinion that we can actually discuss skills, education, and mobility jointly?
Thank you, Anna. The lady over here. Yes, please keep your hand up so Maggie knows.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Pope. I'm with the Oxfam International here in Brussels. I have a little comment and question for Pavel as well. So I noted that you mentioned this idea of a spirit of partnership and a more comprehensive approach in the external dimension, which is very positive. However, you also mentioned the NDICI and this 10% migration component as an example of this. But we recently published some research on specifically this 10% migration component. We actually looked at what exactly is being funded on the ground in some of the key partner countries in terms of migration. And what we found there is quite a different story in the sense that around a third of the projects that are being funded appear to breach international aid rules as put forward by the OECD. Largely because they appear to prioritize the EU's domestic migration concerns over the economic benefit or poverty reduction in the partner country. We also found that some of them breached the EU's own rules, the NDICI rules on human rights compliance. For example, the EU is currently using its aid funding to fund the Libyan and Tunisian coast guards. And final point, maybe, because this is also interesting, the overriding focus of the project statistically is border management, border control, and returns. We saw a tiny fraction of projects on safe and regular pathways, or as you say, remittances, transfers. So I wonder whether you have any reflections on this.
Thank you. No, thank you. I just need to take another question, but thank you very much for those questions. Yes, please, gentleman over here. A quick one.
Thank you very much. I'm Jesper Bjarnason from the Nordic Africa Institute. So many speakers have been talking about the need for more comprehensive approaches to migration, to more inclusive strategies with a better voice for voices from the global south. I'm just wondering what happened to the Global Compact for Migration, which was negotiated through the UN. It also links sustainable development to migration. It was actually, you know, a very large scale sort of negotiation. What happened to it? Why is the EU not more explicit about it? Thank you.
Thank you very much for that. So now just the rules. I'm going to start with you, Paul, and then I'm going to go to Linda, Catherine, and then Ambassador for you to wrap up, and then a few words from me. So Paul, please.
Yes, thank you.
You don't have to answer each and every question, but I think there were some that were very, very important that you answer.
I'll give it a try.
Yeah.
You know, that's all what we do anyway. Just give our best. Starting with, for example, Global Compact for Migration, I mean, definitely Commission was very much supportive and is still supportive. And we, you know, we participate and contribute to all the regional development and the global discussion. And the spirit of that, I think, is still very much present in what we try to develop. Now, institutionally, as the EU, you might remember that the EU as such was not really fully able to subscribe to the compact due to some of the member states. And well, unfortunately, we don't have a comfort in the EU just to disconnect from the member states. You know, one of the problems, by the way, is, you know, we are member states. I mean, it's not a problem. It's maybe a problem of perception. I mean, sometimes we are perceived as something different than member states. And actually, we are member states. So we just need to make sure that, okay, we are all on the same line. And unfortunately, for Global Compact, we were not, at least at the moment of inception. Now, we're going to the, but again, I mean, we are very much supporting and developing policies in that spirit. The 10%, well, as I said, it's not only about 10%, because, you know, 10% is a minimum goal, and we really want that in general, the overall spirit of our development assistance is also inspired by the migration related needs. Secondly, some of the I don't know where did you get the data and for which countries did you make the study, but I mean, and by the way, this is I cannot give you like from the top of my head the numbers. Of course, there are border management related issues that we finance, but there are also awful lot of reintegration money, which was devoted to the movement of the between North Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa and Asia. There is also a lot of on root causes. So I wouldn't say that, you know, we just do border management. We do border management inter alia also because this is the request of those countries. And this is also a little bit to the question about, you know, how do we spend the money? And sometimes it's not efficient. And of course, it is not, because probably if we took all the money spent for the last 50 years, we should have been in totally different point in Africa than we are now. But the thing is that, of course, there were issues that we need to address on our side, but I think it's a question of how do we design and we use this money together with the partner countries, because it's not, you know, I mean, even at the first phase value, you know, we cannot be just, you know, accused that we mismanage the money. I mean, it is a partnership spirit, and the money is also co-designed with the partner countries. Now, I think that connect migration, that we have good enough connection. No, probably we are not yet there. But again, the talent partnership is the attempt to do it. Having said this, while already putting this in place, I can tell you that it's very easy to set, but already to do a proper gap analysis. What do we need? Where? In which member state? Let's not forget that the structure of the labor markets varies tremendously from one member state to another. Then you go to, so that is already at the level of gaps. Now, when you go to the skills and to the recognition of diplomas, recognition of education, that's yet totally another issue. So again, we are tackling that as part of talent partnerships, but it's the way is still far. Well, I hope that I addressed all. To be honest, I didn't get very much the question on double standards, but I'm happy to take it aside if needed.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Paul. There will be refreshments and a time for conversation afterwards. So I won't push you too much on some of the issues that have been raised as well. The Global Gateway that Asad talked about remains a fascination for many of us in the room. Sorry, I chuckle. Right. Linda, the question of the brain, circulation, brain drain.
Yeah. I think it's a very critical question, and I feel like it's a question of who's benefiting at this point. I feel I'll add an extra element to that as brain waste as well, because you can find that we do have medical doctors who have come and trained in Kenya, and they've gone to UK or another country, and they're operating as nurses, and they're doing basically, they're being de-skilled. So there's an aspect of brain waste. How do you factor that into the negotiation process? On the flip side, there's also brain waste of those returning, because I know of a nuclear physicist from DC. He wanted to come back. We do not have at that time anything to do with nuclear energy. So our the governments, the source country governments, actually looking at what skills do we have out there? How do we create legal pathways or proper return pathways, return and reintegration? Because remember, you've gone abroad, everything has changed, your language, your behavior, your mannerisms. And I speak, like for me, that was difficult because I actually spent 16 years abroad. So I had to relearn my language, relearn my culture, relearn how to work in Kenya, because I left as a child, came as an adult. So it's one of those aspects. Don't look at the economic return process. There's that social aspect, the cultural aspect, because the identity has changed. So I think brain drain is something we're still trying to figure out as countries. And most of the time, diaspora policies are very economic-centered remittances. So how do we actually now create a pathway that says social remittances, the skills that you have, and linking it with financial remittances and putting more value on the skill set? Because there are many people out there who are generating a lot of skill, but they're being wasted. I know of many PhD graduates in senior position economists. They're working in a farm right now because they can't find a job. Master's graduates, as in we're producing skills, highly skilled people, but we're wasting their brains. So how do we balance that? Is that conversation being heard? I think it's an important aspect that we need to factor in. Then my sister from Nigeria, I've not actually read the report, but it's a challenge I experience myself sometimes. So sometimes it's one of those aspects that we need to be in the room having that conversation about the voices, the realities on the ground. And I'll add a different layer to that, because I work at a national level, but also local level. But I realize in Kenya, we have counties. There's no understanding of county level migration dynamics. They don't know about migration, even what migration is. Migration to them is an immigrant or diaspora. So I think there are several aspects that we need to unpack, and we need to be part of the conversation, and we need to write it from our lens. And just one last thing, it's going to be short, I promise. It's on the GCM. Kenya actually has an implementation plan that is linking the GCM to national approaches. And this is a comprehensive strategy that about 35 government policymakers are involved in the process. So this is the first time they're trying to integrate that and localize what migration means. So they're testing it. We'll have at least something to look at in the next 5 years, hopefully. So at least that's something that I feel like most African countries are taking seriously. But on the other side, how do you balance that as well? So thank you.
Thank you very much, Linda. Catherine?
Thank you. And I might come in first with the question here that was very interesting, and I think illustrates exactly the use of evidence in some of these policies which should be taking place. Investment to support economic development based on the assessment of people from the place. And I think this is a part of the discussion here is also that what is a traditional development paradigm is over. We're looking at new approaches to supporting livelihoods, development, new forms of partnership between Europe and Africa. But there has to be some sort of middle ground between the traditional, let's say, paternalistic, sometimes hypocritical approach and what we see now, driven by the so-called geopolitical Europe trying to prioritize its narrow agenda. So I think the interesting stuff is exactly in the territory that you describe, and that requires using evidence, expertise, what we've heard here from panelists, rather than cheap political gimmicks that come, unfortunately, from some politicians and political leaders. I would also say that when I heard you speaking, I see how changing the narrative and the approach in Europe, the private sector is so important because you can have much more influence than we can as NGOs shouting at politicians. So I think that is also where I see something hopeful in Europe, that the pressure from that side. Mm-hmm. And then just to come in one other question, if I may, I was pleased to hear the EAS talking about broader approach and different priorities. I mean, I think it has to be that to have a credible external policy. It's just unfortunate when we hear that contradicted, for instance, by a commissioner talking about the deal with Egypt and only about it being a way to stop migration and let's not have all these displaced people from Gaza coming here. So sometimes the broader approach, which might be what's happening in practice, is not always communicated because there is an attempt to play to different audiences. And while understanding that, of course, the EU is its member states, and being a citizen of two EU member states, I'm very aware of that as well. I think sometimes there has been, in recent years, a process of the institutions trying to do what the member states want to the exclusion of, for instance, what the Lisbon Treaty says. I think that there is a need for balance, and why, having invested and created External Action Service, why not try to be innovative in all of that? And as a final note on climate, yes, climate change leads to more displacement. That doesn't mean that more people will be coming to Europe. Most exactly. people move within the continents or to neighbouring countries.
Or within the country.
Within the country, internally yeah. displaced, there needs to be ways to support them there without the panic that they may be moving in another direction. And of course, prevention is always the best way to manage displacement.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Catherine. So, Ambassador, there was a very, very interesting question from our Nigerian colleague about Team Africa. Maybe you could start with that.
Well, maybe Linda should have spoken on Team Africa more than I. But what I want to really address more is to start with the Global Compact. The Global Compact for the African Union is part and parcel of all our frameworks. The institution I'm directing is based on the implementation of the Global Compact. It's about the knowledge and analysis that we need to find in order to change the narrative. I scribbled so much here, but I just want to speak about a few elements for the sake of time. One of them is in relation to the IT, for example, and that saves us from the brain drainage, because if we speak about the IT, what we call about digital migration, this is exactly it. You keep people where they are, and they will work and earn good money, so they don't need to come to another part of the world. When it comes to all the projects and the programs that have been done, I do agree that they have to be looked at in a different way. First, the evaluation, the gaps, and also to see what are we investing in, and do we take people into consideration or only speak in our meeting rooms in the abstract without thinking what's happening, which is actually in relation to the issue of returnees and what our Nigerian colleague said. And here I have to make the distinction between refugees and between migrants, because nobody's speaking about that. And this is a serious issue. When I'm throwing everybody out, including asylum seekers, here we are not honoring at all the Refugee Convention. The other one, I'm not honoring human rights. So it's an issue. Climate mobility, it's part and parcel of our work because we are aware of it in Africa. It's a problem within Africa, within the states themselves, that might be a ticking bomb in the near future. And this is something that we are very keen to continue working on because it's a priority for us. And we have just adopted, like basically we expanded the Kampala Ministerial Declaration on climate change and migration to the continental level. I actually acted as the lead rapporteur for that entire document. When we speak about the investing in people, I think it's very important, and I need to finish
with one comment in relation to funding versus resources. With all due respect, and I'm not speaking here as a politician, I'm just speaking as an African citizen. If you think about the amount of money that you paid in what's so called development in Africa versus the amount of money that has been lost from Africa in selling resources cheaper, we need to think about seriously. When we speak about funding and changing the narrative, you mentioned Gaza and displacement. Some, Catherine, I think you mentioned paying for displacement. This is the whole thing, and I want to end with this. I will not change the narrative by changing the politics without stopping the funding for wars. That's the whole thing. If the funding stopped for the war in Gaza, we will not have the problem with the refugees coming out of Gaza. So this is something also we have to reflect on. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much to the panelists. Now, before I give the floor to Daniel Fatibene, who is going to give remarks on behalf of the ETTG, just a few words. Thank you, first of all, to all four of you for some very, very wise comments and insights that you provided on this question. I think all of us here, probably all of us in the world, agree that we need a well-managed migration, refugee, and asylum policy. And of course, where we diverge is on how to achieve this balance, right? And of course, the far right has a solution. Keep them away. Keep them away. Fences, borders, moats, pushbacks, illegal pushbacks, all of that. They have a narrative, Ambassador. They have a very, very simple and compelling narrative for people. And I think as a writer, an author, you know, an analyst, I found that narratives are extremely important. So, and we don't really have one. At least we do have one. We've heard it here. We've heard it from Paul. We've heard it from the ambassador. We've heard it from Catherine and Linda. But we do not have, I sometimes wonder, and I have to say I reflect on this, why are we not able to communicate with the same power, the same potency as our far-right politicians are doing? And I think it's because our leaders are afraid of coming out very openly about the need for more humane, but also more practical policies. And I think they're actually amplifying the message of the far right by embracing many, many of their elements into our policies. And I'm actually going to speak about this tomorrow at the conference, ODI conference that continues tomorrow. Many of these points will be raised. And I think that somehow makes us all complicit. It's not just the far right. It's mainstream politicians and mainstream policymakers who are falling into the far right trap, as I wrote about some months ago. I'm very, very pleased to say that there was mention of values all the time, our values, our commitments to human rights conventions, the ones that we inspired and the ones that we crafted as well. So with those words, I'm going to pass over to Daniele, and please join me in thanking our panelists for this exchange. For this extremely valuable conversation. Daniel.
Thank you very much once again for the brilliant moderation, but I had no doubts about this, Shada. So thank you so much. I'm Daniele Fatibene. I'm the coordinator of the European Think Tanks Group, which is the umbrella under which this very successful event took place, a very important item in Brussels, especially in these days. I'm not an expert on migration, so I will bring your attention, knowing that I have a very uneasy job because I'm separating you from the drinks. But I promise, in 5 minutes, you will start cheering and drinking. So I collected several elements from the discussion and from the very nice Q&A session. Very insightful comments, points, and I really like the honest level of debate we had. This is what we are trying to do with our colleagues within this partnership with the nice support of OSF. So the first one is consensus. We are facing an issue of consensus within and outside Europe. Elections are upcoming, and we know that the forecasts are not very promising with regards to the level of debate on migration. So we have to monitor that very carefully. And we have an issue of consensus within the European Union. And I really like the idea of rebalancing and reforging the agenda of the EU on foreign policy without taking too much into consideration the clashes that are faced at the level of the EU member states. And I really like the idea that externalizing migration does not mean outsourcing migration, because this also comes hand in hand, as we know, with sometimes human rights violations, and we really need to take care of these values, because otherwise we're losing trust from our international partners. The second point is on resources. And I think our colleagues from the CSOs and NGOs community really raised important concerns after the midterm review of the MFF and on the resources allocated to NDICI. So we really have to monitor that very closely. And I also think, as Ambassador said, that bridging the financial gap is essential. We need to provide enough and quality resources to tackle migration issues. And I think that the next MFF will also be essential to see how member states are really committing to this demands at the global level. But we need a third point, human-centered approaches and human-centered solutions. We spoke today about legal pathways. We spoke about the clash between brain drain and brain gain, which I really liked. But we also know that it's not easy to understand who is negotiating on the tables and bringing unusual suspects, bringing policy analysts, bringing NGOs, bringing activists, bringing lawyers and advocates of human rights to those tables is not easy. So that is something that we also need to do as think tankers, as conveners of this kind of debates. And last point, we need to change narratives, and we need to face very successful narratives that the far right is bringing to this debate. And the best way to do that is to build trust and work with partners to have a successful narrative, which I think should be based not just, as the speaker said, on this over-obsession on migration, but on decent jobs, decent opportunities that need to be created on the field. And those initiatives, that the ones that you are conducting, are extremely interesting, because we need to create decent jobs for people to stay. And for people to stay, as all the panelists said, with decent opportunities and with the capacity to build their own future within Africa. People will move, because mobility is at the center of human life, but this is a small fraction comparing to the amount of opportunities that are still available in the African continent. And how are we trying to do that? As a network of think tanks, we are organizing several events under this OSF partnership in the next few months. This is just the first of a series of events we'll have in Europe, but especially in Africa, because what we do as European think tanks is also to work as network of networks, building on the alliances, building on the partnerships that all our six members have. And we will have another meeting in Kenya on green industrialization and how to create green jobs in Africa for Africans at the end of May. We will have another event in Ghana in September, where we'll also address the issue of digitalization and how artificial intelligence and misinformation are making the debate around elections in Africa very tense and very complicated, fueling also anti-governmental demonstrations. And we know that in some regions of Africa, unconstitutional changes of government are a reality, and we need to also address these challenges to create a frank dialogue with our partners. And we'll also have another meeting in Morocco in September, in Rabat, where we'll address with Africans the issue of green finance. Because I think one of the narratives that needs to be changed is also to have as I said, a people-centered approach, but also bring new topics to the debate, like climate. We didn't discuss too much about climate today, but I think in Africa, it is something that needs to be tackled. So in the next few months, we will publish several analyses, policy briefs, reports, events, because this is a long project that lasts until the end of 2026. So I strongly invite you to check our website and also our members' websites to see how we are progressing on that. But before closing, let me say once again, thank you to the panelists, to Shada, and most of all to the team who made this possible, ODI colleagues, ECDPM colleagues, the colleagues from the Nordic Africa Institute, because this would have been possible without them. So I strongly invite you now to join again me in a round of applause for the panel, and then we can keep our conversations with nice refreshment and drinks that are just waiting for you on the other side of the room. I'm sorry for those who are connected online. Thank you so much and enjoy your night.